Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, November 7th, 2020. Section A. UTPB student earns National Gold Award by Ruth Campbell. University of Texas Permian Basin freshman Abigail Plunkett is in select company, having been selected as a Gold Award Girl Scout winner. The Gold Award is similar to an Eagle Scout Award, but Plunkett said more goes into the Girl Scout version. The project took about 2 years to complete and was fulfilled in her hometown of Houston. To earn a Gold Award, each Girl Scout must complete 2 senior or ambassador journeys, or complete 1 senior or ambassador journey and have earned a Girl Scout Silver Award, the Girl Scouts website said. After completing either of these requirements, a minimum of 80 hours is suggested to complete the steps to earn the Girl Scout Gold Award, the site said. Plunkett said earning the national honor was awesome and very cool because it's a big recognition. I'll get to advocate for scouts on a national level and advocate for disability rights and stuff like that, Plunkett said. Her local troop, Girl Scouts of San Jacinto, is thrilled about her win. We are immensely proud of Abigail, said Mary Vitek, Chief Executive Officer of Girl Scouts of San Jacinto. She took matters into her own hands when she saw an opportunity to make the world a better place, and ultimately, that's what being a Girl Scout is all about. For her award, Plunkett said she installed an ADA-approved wheelchair ramp at her local community theater. Then I developed and implemented a 2-week summer camp program for kids with cognitive and or physical disabilities, Plunkett said. I brought the kids in. We auditioned them. I took all the information about what they needed help with, what skills they wanted to learn, and I taught local teens, which are all actors around my area, how to work with those children. Then we worked with them for 2 weeks and did a show for them at the end of those 2 weeks at Playhouse 1960. She added. The show was a review. We picked several different songs that would work for each kid. They actually got to build their own choreography on it from what we taught them. It was pretty cool. Each one spotlighted each kid. I assistant directed a couple of shows before I directed the summer camp. There were 13 kids, she said. She had participants contact her first to make sure she could accommodate their disability because I was only one person and I was learning along the way as well. I had help from a physical therapist who worked with children with cognitive and physical disabilities and then a special education specialist. They taught her how to accommodate all the youngsters. I don't think I had to turn anyone away, Plunkett said. I was able to accommodate several different disabilities. The idea for her project came from a young girl who attended an audition for a show Plunkett's mother was directing that Plunkett was in. The young woman was deaf in one ear, and she had an amazing voice, but Plunkett said she had never landed a main role at any theaters because she wasn't able to hear properly with the music sometimes. And the microphones normally cover up the ear she can hear out of, and she would get out of time with the music, Plunkett said. So my dad made an accommodation to it, and I realized that it's really easy to accommodate to things, and why doesn't everyone accommodate so everyone can be involved, she added. Plunkett was in Girl Scouts for 13 years. Her mother was a Girl Scout, and her grandmother was a troop leader. Whenever my school had their registration event, my mom wanted to get me involved to make sure I made some new friends and had a sisterhood, she added. Girl Scouts, she said, prepared her for life, besides just school and academics. I felt like I learned some leadership skills. I learned a lot of business skills, especially through the cookie selling. It's not just selling the cookies. I've learned a lot from it. I've learned basic outdoor skills, Plunkett said. She said she's done some acting, but she's mostly been involved in technical theater, building sets, for example. A member of the UTPB swim team, Plunkett also is in the honors program. She is studying kinesiology on a physical therapy track. The university's new D. Kirk Edwards Family Human Performance Center is part of the reason she decided on UTPB. Kinesiology is such a growing major here at the school. A lot of the schools I was looking at, it looked like that major was kind of going downhill and wasn't getting professors and new studies and stuff, Plunkett said. I'm hoping to work with people with disabilities in the future as a physical therapist, she added. ECISD to get rapid COVID tests. Ector County ISD next week will receive 10,000 self-administered COVID-19 rapid tests. Superintendent Scott Murray made the announcement during Thursday night's ECISD live broadcast. The state of Texas last week announced an opportunity for school districts to incorporate testing, and we volunteered for that opportunity. So next week, ECISD will receive 10,000 COVID-19 rapid tests, and these tests are pretty interesting. It's a brand new test, Murray said. You actually administer the test yourself if you're an adult or a high school student. It's a nasal swab, but not quite like the PCR tests that are used in our hospitals, so it's not as invasive as some of the other tests. He said the accuracy rate is 97%. We are very excited about this test. It is a quick test, which means you get your results in 3 to 15 minutes. Again, next week, we will have those tests, and we're going to start phasing in our usage of those tests. The first group of people that we will start with will be our staff members. So any staff member during the day that demonstrates any symptoms, any COVID-19 symptoms, those staff members will have an opportunity to take that test, administer it themselves, and then within just a few minutes, we'll have the results of those tests and we'll follow up appropriately, Murray said. If a staff member tests positive, they will be sent home to quarantine. If they are negative, they may still be sent home if they aren't feeling well, but at least we'll know that it's not COVID-19. Once we are comfortable with the process with staff members, we will begin to transition into students. So during the school day, any student who displays COVID-19 symptoms, we will have that testing opportunity available for kids. And we will need, of course, parent permission. Parents will be notified, and if the child displays symptoms, the parent will be asked if they would like their child to be tested at school. They will know in just a few minutes if the test is positive, and they can respond immediately to that, Murray said. We are excited about this testing opportunity, he added. We know that it will help us become more focused in dealing with the outbreak that is occurring in our community. Then all of those results will be reported to our health department. We will report those results on the ECISD dashboard as well. Quick Hits Exhibition. Ellen Knoll Art Museum, 4909 East University, has scheduled a comic exhibition, BAM, it's a picture book, The Art Behind Graphic Novels, on loan from the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature, through Sunday. The exhibition features some of today's leading and best graphic novelists of the illustration world, Mark Criley, Matthew Holm, Jarrett J. Kurzowska, Lincoln Pierce, and Raina Telgemeier. Admission is free. Museum hours are from noon to 5 p.m. Monday through Sunday, and noon to 8 p.m. Thursdays. For more information, call Ashley Flores at 432-550-9696, extension 214, or visit knollartmuseum.org. Building Inspection Office operates with limited staff. Due to possible COVID-19 exposure, the City of Odessa's Building Inspection Office is operating with an extremely limited staff. Officials are requesting that the public use the department's website to perform routine requests when possible. Due to reduced staffing, the public should expect longer than normal wait times to have their requests responded to, inspection officials warned in a Friday news release. Emergency requests are receiving first priority. For more information, contact Building Inspection at 335-4143 or visit the office's website. On the net, tinyurl.com/y5319wgo. Local news roundup. Exhibition. Perceiving Emotion, BFA Capstone Exhibition by Ezequiel Hernandez will be on display Monday through November 20th at Sol Ross State Fine Arts Gallery, Francois Fine Arts Building, Room 102, 79830 on US 90 in Alpine. An exhibition of various portraits painted in a variety of historic styles. Gallery hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays. For more information, call 432-837-8218 or visit solross.edu. Odessa Recycles Day. Keep Odessa Beautiful has scheduled Odessa Recycles Day from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. November 12th and 13th at the Odessa Recycling Center, 816 West 42nd. Aluminum cans buyback. Special rate is 20 cents. On November 13th, free shredding up to 3 office-size boxes per household. No digital media, CDs, USBs, thumb drives, etc. The event is drive-through to keep everyone safe. Call 335-4686 or visit keepodessabeautiful.org. Police searching for man wanted in connection to sexual assault of a child. Bonham teacher placed on paid administrative leave. The Odessa Police Department is asking for the public's help to locate a wanted 36-year-old man in connection to sexually assaulting a child, a press release detailed. Jesus Rafael Martinez, 36, a teacher at Bonham Middle School, is currently wanted for sexual assault of a child, a second-degree felony, and improper relationship between educator and student, a second-degree felony. Martinez was placed on paid administrative leave after Ector County ISD was notified by OPD of an investigation into the teacher. Martinez could reportedly be in the El Paso area. I am horrified and angry, ECISD Superintendent of Schools Scott Murray stated in a press release. I want to say again to our community, we will not tolerate inappropriate behavior from our employees. I want to remind our community that every year we require training on the topic of inappropriate student-teacher relationships. There is no excuse for our employees to misunderstand the seriousness of these actions. We will continue to do everything we can to prevent this behavior. Right now, our district joins OPD in asking the public for help locating the man. If you have any information that will help the police, we urge you to call the Odessa Police Department or Odessa Crime Stoppers. Odessa Police Department 432-333-3641. Odessa Crime Stoppers 432-333-TIPS. Local news roundup. Police investigating multiple shots fired and burglaries. The Odessa Police Department is investigating a string of incidents which include a person being shot and multiple burglaries, a press release detailed. OPD reportedly responded to a gunshot victim at 10:03 p.m. Thursday in the 2000 block of Gila Road. Investigation showed that the victim was shot by unknown subjects and later transported to a local hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. OPD spokesperson Corporal Steve Lisser stated via text message Friday afternoon that the gunshot victim has been treated and released. Police then responded to a robbery at 10:50 p.m. Thursday near the intersection of Grant and Clements, the press release stated. There were no reports of any injuries. At 10:51 p.m., police reportedly responded to shots fired at the Chaparral Village Apartments, 1411 South Grant, which is less than half a mile south of Clements. Investigation showed that unknown subjects committed an auto burglary. When the owner of the vehicle confronted the suspects shot at the victim. The victim had no injuries as a result of the incident. Police then reportedly responded to a home invasion at 12:05 a.m. in the 2500 block of West 10th. There were no reports of any injuries. All of these incidents are believed to be connected, the press release stated. Two juveniles are in custody and more suspects are being sought. Anyone with information about the incidents is asked to contact the Odessa Police Department or Odessa Crime Stoppers. More information will be released as soon as it becomes available. Man charged with stalking ex-wife. A 43-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly damaged two vehicles that were in the driveway of his ex-wife's residence and tampered with his ex-wife's surveillance cameras. Trinity Wayne Coleman was charged with stalking, a third-degree felony. On March 5th, the complainant, identified as Candace Buckner, reported to OPD that two vehicles in the driveway of her residence, located in the 1400 block of Westbrook Avenue, had been damaged overnight, and her surveillance cameras had been tampered with, the OPD probable cause affidavit stated. Buckner stated she believed her ex-husband, Coleman, to be responsible for the damage. Several neighborhood surveillance cameras reportedly showed someone in a Dodge Ram truck, not unlike Coleman's, had tampered with Buckner's surveillance cameras, while repair estimates showed the subject inserted sugar in the gas tanks of the vehicles. Buckner showed video surveillance from her backyard, showing that a subject wearing a mask entering her backyard March 9th and tampering with the camera. The subject was seen carrying a long club-like instrument. The subject left evidence at the scene, which included the duct tape, gloves, a hammer, bolt cutters, and cans of spray paint, the affidavit stated. Buckner reportedly detailed this occurrence terrified her and made her fear for the physical safety of her and her children, as well as for her property. She stated she believed the individual on the camera to be Coleman. Buckner also showed officers text messages from her phone that over a period of several months, Coleman sent her more than 100 text messages after she had told him to leave her alone and not contact her again, the affidavit stated. The text messages were annoying, embarrassing, tormenting, or alarming. Coleman had reportedly also been arrested in October 2019 for harassment and assault against Buckner. Jail records show Coleman was also charged with false alarm or report, a Class A misdemeanor, as he was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center November 30, 2019. Coleman was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center for the stalking charge Wednesday. Jail records show he had one bond totaling $20,000 and posted bail Thursday. ECSO looking for males involved in robbery at gunpoint. The Ector County Sheriff's Office is reportedly investigating a woman who was robbed at gunpoint in North Odessa. The reported robbery happened at 9 p.m. Thursday in the 5900 block of El Paso Avenue, ECSO press release stated. The victim was reportedly confronted by four males in a black SUV. The male subjects exited the vehicle with firearms and forced the victim to the ground and demanded her belongings. The male subject stole the victim's purse and left the scene in the black SUV. Anyone with information about the case is asked to contact Ector County Sheriff's Office at 432-335-3050 in reference to case number 20-E5686. Obituaries for Saturday, November 7th. Antonio Padron. Antonio Tony Padron, 74, passed away Saturday, October 31st. He was born July 5th, 1946, in Big Spring to Florencio and Marta Padron. He married his wife Josie in 1965 in Big Spring. Survivors include his daughters Michelle Ibarra and husband Oscar, Anna Hernandez and husband Jesse, Angela Wolf and husband Kevin, his son Michael Padron and wife Margarita, brothers Susana and Carlos, sisters Lupe Martinez, Julie Hernandez, Esther Cunningham, and Delia Salazar, eight grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his wife Josie, his parents, his brothers Santos and Crescencio, and sister Maria Padron. A viewing and rosary will be Sunday, November 8th from 4 to 8 p.m. at La Paz Funeral Home. A funeral service will be Monday, November 9th at 10 a.m. at Holy Redeemer in Odessa, followed by burial with military honors at Ector County Cemetery. Richard H. Garza. Richard H. Garza was born July 3, 1937, and passed away in Seguin, October 21st. He was born in Mission to Anastasio and Amelia Garza. Gravesite services will be held at 10:30 Saturday, November 7th at San Jose Cemetery in Mission. All CDC protocol must be followed, including social distancing and face coverings worn. Tommy Joanne Gatlin Stanford, Belleville. Tommy Joanne Gatlin Stanford was born May 10th, 1931, to Thomas James Gatlin and Willie Myrtle Simmons, and passed away October 28th at the age of 89. Joanne married Billy Lee Stanford in 1949 in Odessa, and they were married for over 71 years. Joanne is survived by her four children, Mark and spouse Ann, Becky, Nathan and spouse Rita, and Tina and spouse Rick, 11 grandchildren and five great-grandchildren. A memorial service for Joanne Stanford will be held at a later date in Belleville. In lieu of flowers, please consider donating to her favorite charity, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, November 8, 2020. Front page. Election. President-elect Biden says he seeks to unify the nation. From the Associated Press. Democrat Joe Biden defeated President Donald Trump to become the 46th President of the United States on Saturday, positioning himself to be a leader who seeks not to divide but to unify a nation gripped by a historic pandemic and a confluence of economic and social turmoil. "I sought this office to restore the soul of America," said Biden in a primetime victory speech not far from his Delaware home. and to make America respected around the world again, and to unite us here at home. His victory came after more than 3 days of uncertainty as election officials sorted through a surge of mail-in votes that delayed processing. Biden crossed the winning threshold of 270 Electoral College votes with a win in Pennsylvania. Trump refused to concede, threatening further legal action on ballot counting. Biden, 77, staked his candidacy less on any distinctive political ideology than on galvanizing a broad coalition of voters around the notion that Trump posed an existential threat to American democracy. The strategy proved effective, resulting in pivotal victories in Michigan and Wisconsin, as well as Pennsylvania, one-time Democratic bastions that had flipped to Trump in 2016. Biden's victory was a repudiation of Trump's divisive leadership, and the president-elect now inherits a deeply polarized nation grappling with foundational questions of racial justice and economic fairness, while in the grips of a virus that has killed more than 236,000 Americans and reshaped the norms of everyday life. Kamala Harris made history as the first black woman to become vice president, an achievement that comes as the U.S. faces a reckoning on racial justice. The California senator, who is also the first person of South Asian descent elected to the vice presidency, will become the highest-ranking woman ever to serve in government, 4 years after Trump defeated Hillary Clinton. Harris introduced Biden as a president for all Americans who would look to bridge a nation riven with party and partisanship, and nodded to the historic nature of her ascension to the vice presidency. Dream with ambition, lead with conviction, and see yourselves in a way that others may not simply because they've never seen it before, Harris said. You chose hope and unity, decency, science, and yes, truth. You ushered in a new day for America. Biden was on track to win the national popular vote by more than 4 million, a margin that could grow as ballots continue to be counted. Nonetheless, Trump was not giving up. Departing from long-standing Democratic tradition and signaling a potentially turbulent transfer of power, he issued a combative statement saying his campaign would take unspecified legal actions. And he followed up with a bombastic, all-caps tweet in which he falsely declared, "I won the election, got 71 million legal votes." Twitter immediately flagged it as misleading. Trump has pointed to delays in processing the vote in some states to allege with no evidence that there was fraud and to argue that his rival was trying to seize power, an extraordinary charge by a sitting president trying to sow doubt about a bedrock democratic process. Trump is the first incumbent president to lose re-election since Republican George H.W. Bush in 1992. He was golfing at his Virginia country club when he lost the race. He stayed out for hours, stopping to congratulate a bride as he left, and his motorcade returned to the White House to a cacophony of shouts, taunts, and unfriendly hand gestures. In Wilmington, Delaware, near the stage that, until Saturday night, had stood empty since it was erected to celebrate on election night, people cheered and pumped their fists as the news that the presidential race had been called for the state's former senator arrived on their cell phones. On the nearby water, two men in a kayak yelled to a couple passing by in the opposite direction, "Joe won! They called it!" as people on shore whooped and hollered. Harris, in workout gear, was shown on video speaking to Biden on the phone, exuberantly telling the president-elect, "We did it." Biden was expected to take the stage for a drive-in rally after dark. Across the country, there were parties and prayer. In New York City, spontaneous block parties broke out. People ran out of their homes, banging on pots. They danced and high-fived with strangers amid honking horns. Among the loudest cheers were those for passing U.S. Postal Service trucks. People streamed into Black Lives Matter Plaza near the White House, near where Trump had ordered the clearing of protesters in June, waving signs and taking cell phone pictures. In Lansing, Michigan, Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter demonstrators filled the Capitol steps. The lyrics to Amazing Grace began to echo through the crowd, and Trump supporters laid their hands on a counter protester and prayed. Americans showed deep interest in the presidential race. A record 103 million voted early this year, opting to avoid waiting in long lines at polling locations during the pandemic. With counting continuing in some states, Biden had already received more than 74 million votes, more than any presidential candidate before him. Trump's refusal to concede has no legal implications, but it could add to the incoming administration's challenge of bringing the country together after a bitter election. Throughout the campaign, Trump repeatedly refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, arguing without evidence that the election could be marred by fraud. The nation has a long history of presidential candidates peacefully accepting the outcome of elections, dating back to 1800, when John Adams conceded to his rival, Thomas Jefferson. It was Biden's native Pennsylvania that put him over the top, the state he invoked throughout the campaign to connect with working-class voters. He also won Nevada on Saturday, pushing his total to 290 Electoral College votes. Biden received congratulations from dozens of world leaders, and his former boss, President Barack Obama, saluted him in a statement declaring the nation was fortunate that Joe's got what it takes to be president and already carries himself that way. Republicans on Capitol Hill were giving Trump and his campaign space to consider all their legal options. It was a precarious balance for Trump's allies as they try to be supportive of the president and avoid risking further fallout, but face reality of the vote count. On Saturday, Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had not yet made any public statements, either congratulating Biden or joining Trump's complaints. But retiring GOP Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is close to McConnell, said, "After counting every valid vote and allowing courts to resolve disputes, it is important to respect and promptly accept the results." More than 236,000 Americans have died during the corona pandemic. Nearly 10 million have been infected and millions of jobs have been lost. The final days of the campaign played out against a surge in confirmed cases in nearly every state, including battlegrounds such as Wisconsin, that swung to Biden. Education. Getting students back on campus is Dixon's priority. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. Midland Online Academy will be changing. It appears it is not a matter if, but when. The signature academic program of former Superintendent Orlando Riddick's time with MISD during the pandemic has had problems as far as achievement and resource allocation, and Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon is ready for a change, one that will put more kids back on campus. Dixon told the Reporter Telegram last week that opportunities to bring the students back on campus include requiring those students who participate in extracurricular activities, including athletics, to return to campus. She expects to bring a proposal to trustees this month or next. "The purpose of the online academy was a COVID response option," Dixon said. Mike Morath, commissioner of the Texas Education Agency, said last week that districts could require students to return to campus if there are attendance or performance issues, specifically if a student's grades fall below a 70. Dixon said 30% of Midland ISD's 4,000-plus online academic students are registered but not engaged. She also questioned the logic of allowing online courses such as culinary arts and welding. A second semester reset could also require those taking specialty or upper-level classes to return to campus. "We can't take a teacher out of the classroom for 2 or 3 weeks," Dixon said. Resource management has become a topic for Dixon to address before Friday's teacher protest at central office. Dixon expressed her frustration with the online academy's impact on resources. She said secondary teachers were, on average, teaching 4 classes for students on campus and 2 online. Teachers said Friday during the protest that they were not happy with the decision to have secondary students back on campus 5 days a week. They said virtual Fridays provided an opportunity to do lesson assignments, grade papers, and prepare themselves for the upcoming week. "We're ready for kids to come back on Friday, but when it's safe and when we're all able to support all the kids," said Megan Gooding, department chair at Lee High School. Dixon said she understood teachers were feeling the pressure of the pandemic, but also said that Midland ISD's calendar has put the district in a position of having to be more efficient with every day of instruction. For instance, there are 166 days of instruction for MISD students and 180 for students at Ector County. She also said that other larger districts around the region have returned to campus 5 days a week. Teachers don't want to come back 5 days, Dixon said. They are coming back. We need kids back. Energy. Analysts. Senate could act as check on Biden energy matters. By Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. As Democrat Joe Biden stands on the cusp of being elected President of the United States, those in the energy industry wonder how that will impact their work. At last week's virtual Lone Star Energy Forum, Greg Gutfeld and Juan Williams, political analysts on Fox News, said they don't believe Biden is as antagonistic toward the oil and gas industry as believed. Two, Gutfeld said he believes a Senate still under Republican control could act as a check on President Biden. The Senate should make you rest easier, he said. They are pro-energy and pro-oil. Moderate Democrats may be too, and the Senate gives them cover. Replied Tom Staples, president of the association, that does make me feel better. Do you agree the Senate will be a stabilizing influence? Williams responded, the cliche is the Senate is the ice that cools a hot drink. The heat coming from the left with pressure on Biden will be from people who want to see tremendous change in terms of the energy industry. There is a battle between those who want no regulations and those who do. He predicted there will be those who come to Biden who favor reasonable restraints. So many in this country have made the environment and climate change a priority, Williams said. I say there's no doing away with oil and gas. You can be in a transitional phase, which is what Biden got in trouble for saying on the debate stage. Some say he's anti-oil and gas. That's not a fair assessment. People want certainty. They want to know what the playing field is before the game begins. We're in a situation where people have a heightened level of concern about the environment. Tornadoes and hurricanes keep coming. There can be a level of certainty without antagonism toward the oil and gas industry, Williams said. Staples agreed there is room for legitimate concerns about the climate. Everyone wants clean air and water, he noted. He asked how to improve the industry's image and attract investors, especially younger investors concerned about environment, social, and governance issues. It's alarming to us there's a campaign talking about getting rid of the very product that forms 96% of the products we use daily, he said. Williams advised continuing to tell the industry story. Help the people understand what fracking is. The perception is when it goes underground and cracks the rock, it can impact underwater streams and driving water and impact drinking water and impacts the environment of the community. If that's not the case, tell your story more effectively. Don't get it defensive about everything. How many jobs does oil and gas support in Texas? 428,000 direct and 2 million indirect, Staples said. Bring that into the picture. We're in a transition period, and there is an opportunity for those jobs as we explore alternative ways to produce energy. There will be jobs in those alternative energies industries. He stressed that a transition will not be a snap process. For oil and gas production in America, we're not talking day to night. We're talking a slowdown, if you will. We're talking a gradual process, not a snap process. You have to be players in that process. If you make yourself in opposition, you're making yourself the bad guys. I see you as a necessary part of the process. You want to say to the public, we understand. We have families, too. Top eight basin counties produce more than half of state's oil. The amount of oil production in the top eight Permian Basin counties made up more than 51% of the preliminary total reported by the Railroad Commission of Texas during the month of August. The commission reported Midland, Martin, and Pecos counties made up the top three, followed by Howard, Upton, Loving, Glasscock, and Reagan. They combined to produce 55.081 million barrels of crude oil, which was 51.02% of the total reported statewide. In July, those eight counties accounted for 52%. Midland and Martin counties combined to produce 23.7 million barrels during the month. That was 21.97% of the oil in August, also a decline from the 22% in July. Midland County alone accounted for 14.25 million barrels, which also was down from 1 month earlier. That total still meant that Midland County was responsible for 13% of the oil statewide in August. The Railroad Commission reported a preliminary total of 107.9 million barrels across the state in August. That was nearly a million barrels less than 1 month earlier. In August 2019, the preliminary production crude oil was 107.1 million barrels. The updated total was 135.8.9 million. Reeves County again dominated the production of gas and condensate. The 87 million MCF produced in August dominated Webb and Midland counties, which totaled 56.5 million MCF and 46.9 million MCF, respectively. The RRC reported 802 million MCF of gas was produced during the entire month. In August 2019, the preliminary number was 764 million MCF. The updated number was 909 million MCF.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read from the Sunday, November 8th, Midland Reporter Telegram. Report states apartment rents drop for 17th straight month, by Stuart Doreen. Apartment rents continued their downward move in October, according to apartmentlist.com. Rent has decreased nearly 30% since October 2019, according to the apartment information website. Apartmentlist.com shows a 29.7% decline year over year in Midland, while the declines are 2.1% across the state and 1.4% across the nation. Apartment List's report showed Midland's rents have dropped for 17 straight months, including a 1.4% decline from September to October and a 21% decline since the COVID-19 pandemic began in March. Median apartment rents in Midland stand at $734 for a one-bedroom apartment and $897 for a two-bedroom apartment, according to the report. Odessa rents are also going down. Apartmentlist.com shows a 35.2% decline in rents year over year and a 27.7% decrease since the beginning of the pandemic in March. The median rents in Odessa were $520 for a one-bedroom apartment and $712 for a two-bedroom apartment. Rent Cafe on its website showed an average rent in Midland around $1,533 in October 2019 and $1,357 in Odessa 1 year ago. Other median rents around the region included $705 for a one-bedroom and $876 for a two-bedroom in Lubbock, $820 and $1,076 in Abilene, and $827 and $1,054 in San Angelo.
Local and national news. State reps say upcoming legislative session will boil down to money, by Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Members of the Texas legislature can expect an 87th legislative session that promises to be difficult due to the economic impact of the novel coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic. Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, noted during the association's virtual Lone Star Energy Forum that legislators won't have the luxury of record-breaking revenues from the oil and gas industry as they did in past sessions, though the industry will still be paying billions in taxes and royalties. Asked by Staples what will be the critical issues of the session, State Rep. Oscar Longoria listed the budget shortfall, which was recently predicted to be about $4 billion. There are a lot of men and women working to make sure we meet our budget, he said. We have a heavy reliance on the oil and gas industry. We get a lot from severance taxes. We need to take care of the industry and ensure it gets out of the tough predicaments it's in. As January approaches, State Rep. Tom Craddock summed up the session this way. Money, money, money. That's what we need to think about. I think money is the key. We have needs, and we're going to have to spend dollars in those areas, like teachers' raises last session. There's additional infrastructure we need to have, and we need additional technology. We're going to have to spend some money. but it will be tough sledding. Craddock said it's important during what could be a contentious session for everyone to work together on the issues. He said he encourages all the elected officials to hold meetings in advance to lay the groundwork to address issues during the session rather than waiting until its final days. State Rep. Chris Patty agreed, "We have limited capacity to get a lot of things done. Particularly if we get there and try to duke it out, we won't get a lot done. If we prepackage bills, it will help. We can get things done during the session." Patty, who chairs the House Energy Committee, said a number of issues are occurring outside his committee. He cited eminent domain and balancing landowner rights of those of the industry needing to move its production to market via pipeline or truck. There's the issue of flaring. I think the industry, for being very involved in this issue, forming a task force trying to find solutions. Awareness has been tremendous. The industry has made great strides already in pipeline infrastructure to reduce flaring, and that connects to eminent domain. You have to get supply to market, and that ties to flaring. You can't be opposed to flaring at the same time you're being opposed to being part of the solution, which is infrastructure to alleviate flaring. Water supplies and disposing the get water produced alongside oil and natural gas are another issue. The downturn could provide the industry the opportunity to find solutions. Craddock sees issues over flaring as best addressed by regulators, specifically the Railroad Commission, rather than by legislators. He called for the agency to have better technology to help oversee the energy industry. He also called for a new way to fund the commission, which is self-funded through fees paid by oil and gas companies. Added Patty, "We do have to look in the budget process to ensure we have a well-funded and functional railroad commission. Activity is down, but that doesn't mean we don't have as much need for enforcement, inspections, all those things. We've done good work in recent sessions to get funding to the Commission for Technology. We need a well-funded, functional railroad commission that can pay and retain people critical to its work." Said Longoria, "It's critically important for everyone to understand, aside from the direct benefits, the indirect benefits of the energy industry. The high wages from the industry translates into sales tax dollars. That's where our budget gets the biggest hit. People aren't spending like they were. That's where we'll see the impact. Oil and gas affects everything directly and indirectly in Texas." Eventually, Craddock also said the state also needs to look for a different way to fund its schools. I don't know what it is, but we need to find it. Region Briefs from the Associated Press. Austin. Texas virus cases rise by 7,677 more than 1,000 in El Paso. The number of reported coronavirus cases in Texas rose by 7,677 Saturday, with more than 1,000 of those in El Paso, where a coronavirus surge has formed a significant part of the COVID-19 trend. The El Paso Health Department reported 1,000 new cases Saturday for a total of 61,104 since the pandemic began, and that 1,064 people were hospitalized as three Air Force medical teams were being sent to assist health officials. Statewide, the Texas Health Department reported 950,549 total cases since the start of the pandemic. The department reported 6,068 people were hospitalized Saturday, and there were 111 additional deaths. There are 122,845 reported active cases, and 811,330 have recovered. El Paso health officials reported four more deaths to raise the count to 661, and five Federal Emergency Management Administrative trailers have been sent to the border city to help accommodate the surge of COVID-19 fatalities. New Mexico. State again reports nearly 1,300 additional cases. New Mexico on Saturday, for the second day in a row, reported nearly 1,300 additional COVID-19 cases and 16 additional deaths. Officials said there are 1,287 additional cases, a one-day record that was the same number reported Friday. But they said Saturday that 10 of the cases reported Friday had turned out to be duplicates or not lab-confirmed. The number of infections is thought to be far higher because many people have not been tested. Studies suggest people can be infected with the virus without feeling sick. State officials warned Thursday that new records would be set over the coming weeks as the rate of spread remains high. The virus doesn't stop spreading on its own, and it spreads exponentially, which means we will see a whole lot more illness and death in our state unless and until New Mexicans turn it around. Governor Lujan Grisham tweeted Friday, "For most people, the new coronavirus causes mild or moderate symptoms such as fever and cough that clear up in 2 or 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia and death. The vast majority of people recover." Oklahoma state more than doubles daily record for new virus cases. The number of newly reported coronavirus cases in Oklahoma on Saturday more than doubled the previous one-day record, and the health department said a backlog of cases and possibly duplicate reporting is the reason. There were 4,741 new cases, bringing the total to 136,492 since the pandemic began. The previous one-day record was 2,101 new cases, was recorded Thursday, as cases in the state have surged in recent weeks.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American, November 8th, 2020. Section A. Lawyer eschews corporate mold. Odessa personal injury attorney lets clients make all the important decisions. By Bob Campbell. You may know attorney Robert White from TV ads in which he stands atop an 18-wheel truck and invites you to call him if you've been hurt by such a truck. That's one side of the 63-year-old Texarkana native who grew up in Hobbs, New Mexico, and Odessa. But as it is with everyone, the full picture is much more complex. White attended Reagan Elementary, Bonham Junior High, and Permian High School, before earning accounting and law degrees at the University of Texas at Austin and the South Texas College of Law in Houston. Then he started learning personal injury law with the late Jerry Childs and Clyde Bishop, who assigned him to workers' compensation cases and whose names are still on his firm. Referring to the late flamboyant Odessa PI lawyer, White said, "I'd be riding my bicycle and see John Watts in his big caddy, smoking a cigar, reading the newspaper, and going down my street at about 5 miles per hour. I always had a lot of empathy for people. I'm more of an inclusive guy. The corporate mold never did suit me. I like helping people. I clerked for a defense firm in Houston and saw Joe Jamail win a $1 million judgment on a rotator cuff case in Bay City. That might have done it for me there. I have never not been busy. There is always something going on." Assisted by his wife, Lori, his office manager, and trial lawyer, Greta Braker, White has 265 cases pending and has won hundreds of millions in settlements during his career, he said. He spends over $100,000 annually on advertising. The Whites have a son. In cases involving vehicles, oil field accidents, medical or pharmaceutical malpractice, and other injurious events, he often uses a focus group to help choose jurors and sometimes calls in Dallas jury selection consultant Kelly Raymond. "It would be nice if I could write them a letter and they'd write me a check, but it doesn't work that way," White said, explaining that it normally takes from 6 months to 2 years to settle a case. Working from his office at 230 West 3rd, the office that the legendary Warren Burnett used from the 1950s into the 90s, he said, "We look at whose fault it was, what type of insurance coverages might be available, and what type of injuries there are. People may get to a point in their treatment where no amount of medicine will make them any better. Then they have to get a life care specialist and live with it. And the only thing I can do is sue for money and work on contingency. I don't file a lawsuit just to make a statement because I could get into trouble for a frivolous pleading." Upon reaching a settlement, White gets 33% of the award, or from 40 to 45% if the case went to trial. In the meantime, pursuing a case to a judgment can be expensive for a plaintiff's lawyer, with a doctor's deposition costing from $5,000 to $10,000, a medical illustration from $15,000 to $25,000, and an accident reconstruction from $50,000 to $300,000. Sometimes people call from a motel and say, "I just got run over by an 18-wheeler," and want us to send a big paycheck, White said. The funniest thing was during my workers' compensation days when a guy came in and hired us and said, "I'm losing everything. Can you loan me $100? He had gone to 10 other lawyers and got $100 from each of them. White's father, Billy Bob, was a sales representative for Humble, Enco, and Exxon, supplying service stations and convenience stores, and his mother, Phyllis Ann, a secretary for the Federal Aviation Administration. He is an only child. I have been asked how I avoid malpractice, but that's backward thinking, White said. You need to be open and honest with your clients. As long as you're doing what you're supposed to be doing and treating them right, everything else falls into place. Develop the case, work it up, and tell them all the pluses and minuses so they can make all the important decisions. Always do your homework and be prepared. With chiropractor Mark Mahaffey, Dr. John Molland, United Fleet Sales owner Shan Johnson, and District Attorney Bobby Bland, White often plays golf at Odessa Country Club in games that the men say are as much jovial camaraderie as sport. Everybody sees the guy standing on top of the truck and yelling into the TV that if you're hurt, call him, Bland said. But if you meet him one-on-one, you know he has a good heart and is a really good guy. He likes to laugh and is very funny. We just enjoy hanging out together. We don't talk politics much because he is a Democrat and I'm a Republican. But other than that, we get along well. Robert is one of those guys who is dedicated to what he does. He cares about his clients and is passionate about being a personal injury lawyer. He's an upbeat guy who has a positive attitude about his work, his family, and everything he does, Bland said. He is kind and generous, and he and Lori throw great little dinner parties. My wife Heather and I are lucky to consider them friends. Johnson said White is a wonderful guy with good morals who loves the Texas Longhorns. If Robert could buy burnt orange underwear, he would have it, Johnson said. I would honestly say that he bleeds burnt orange. Also, avoiding political discussions with White, Johnson said he is a great father and husband and a caring, compassionate friend. I didn't know his father, but his mother was a very sweet lady, Johnson said. His wife has had the most positive influence of any person in his life. They're very grounded and have always had a great marriage. They love each other just like the first day they met. The Whites had just returned from a vacation in Vail, Colorado, and they ski at Beaver Creek, Colorado, and Ruidoso, New Mexico, go to shows in Las Vegas, water surf at Lake LBJ, and ride bicycles around Lady Bird Lake in Austin. When I learned to ski at Ruidoso, they gave me a half day's lesson and took me to the top of a mountain, said White, laughing. We went to Italy 2 years ago, but I would just as soon stay in the U.S. and see all of it. His recreational reading includes Brad Thor and James Patterson, and he and Lori listen to recordings of novels in their car. We've been listening to 28 Summers, which is a love story by Ellen Hildebrand, he said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.